All right. Now, over the past multiple times in this series, I've asked the question, knowing that the church at Ephesus is a good church, why do they need to hear something like that? Well, that's not a question I'm going to put before you this morning, because I'm going to say, now we're starting to get into things that are very obviously intended for the good church. And that's, I would say that because the things that you read about in 25 through 32 are, at least in my mind and even in my experience, some of the very hardest things it is to do as a person in the church, are some of the hardest things we have to do as Christians. Would you agree or disagree with that? What's that? Really? Okay. Anybody else? Glenn, you said something.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Oh. I guess then the logic. Bob, you look like you're about to say something. No? Okay. All right. Teach me to try to read faces there. So, the next logical question then, though, is why are these things so hard?
Living in the world is because it's so easy to just automatically go the easy way. Take that easy way out.
That's a great way of putting it, and something I hadn't thought of, but it's easy to get angry, isn't it? Or it's easy to hold a grudge. Those are incredibly easy things. R.C.?
These are more everyday things. You don't have it. I don't see anything. He says, don't go murdering nobody. Other stuff, which are at the far realm of the scope, the scale. But these are more everyday things than
Absolutely. You had another point there. In some sense, it's easier for a church to deal with things like adultery, or to deal with, like you said, murder or drunkenness or other outwardly immoral actions. These things are tougher. And I think tiny, that's a great way of putting it. That leads into where I was going along with that. And that's because they're easy to hide. They're usually things that don't get outside of your head. But when you think about it, or if you have been in, say, a church where there's been divisiveness, where there's been infighting, that infighting and divisiveness generally has not come about because of the outwardly immoral actions of a person. It has not been directly precipitated by adultery or drunkenness. Now, sometimes, especially if that happens in leadership, yes, that's a case. But more often than not, it's these kind of sins that lead to the fracturing of a church. I'm not seeing any heads nodding, but I'm not seeing any turning from side to side either, so I'll assume that's... But these are hidden sins and things that are very easy for us to cover over, and we generally don't show, at least we don't wear on our sleeves, and generally people aren't going to know about. They're hard for ministers to find out about, or elders, or other leaders in the church. You have to really go looking for them, which is part of the duty of a pastor or an elder, is to find these things too. But what then is the answer to how we combat these things? Well, as Paul lays it down, the answer is really pretty simple. And that's going to be our focal point of our study this morning. The answer to defending ourselves against these kind of sins and against letting them into the church is truth. Truth, speaking truth to each other, speaking truth to ourselves also. Now, we talked about throughout the course of chapter 4 here in Ephesians, the overall theme is unity. But truth is essential to unity. Would everyone concur with that? We found that to be the case. You're not going to stay together if there's not truth and if there's not honesty between Christians. Speaking the truth in love. Now, that means speaking the whole counsel of God, but it also means speaking the whole counsel of God, but it also means speaking to each other about what we see in each other. Now, we have to be careful at how we do that, obviously, which is part of the reason for my little pause there. But, I mean, that's a broad thing, but that's what we're going to be discussing, our seat.
And speaking to each other, what our motive is how we speak. If our motive is to sing somebody, or our motive is the kingdom of God, we will change.
Absolutely, and that's
why we're
okay with the speaking the truth part. The love part is the harder part in that. Helen?
Government has to start in the home, and even small things like sarcasm in jest, ridicule in jest. I was just joking.
Is this another way we cover it over?
Oh,
I mean, most of the time we'll just keep these things in our mind, but even then when we let them out, we've got little ways of blanketing it, or at least trying to round off the edges a little bit so that, oh, it was just a, you know, it's a way of sort of covering our back, oh, it was just a joke, or you're letting your tone try to diffuse it a little bit. But look back, if you will, at verses 21 through 24, things that we studied last week. Phil, would you mind reading those for me, 21 through 24 in chapter 4?
Assuming that you have heard about him and were taught in him as the truth is in Jesus, put off your old self, which belongs to your former manner of life and is corrupt through deceitful desires, and to be renewed in the spirit of your minds, and to put on the new self, created after the likeness of God, in truth, righteousness, and holiness.
We talked last week about the way the world sees the world, so to speak. And we talked about how things like hardness of heart. Now, what in principle is the kind of hardness of heart we're talking about here? Do you remember? What does it mean if someone has a hard heart? Looking back.
Self-motivated.
Self-motivated. Self has a big part to do with... Yeah, that's a big part of it, is not seeking God, seeking self. Phil.
A former pastor say it this way. When a person is living in sin and they're under conviction not to sin, the part of that spirit of God in them dies, and he moves his hand away and harden to the spirit as you live in that continual sin.
Continuing to anybody else? We talked. It's connected with another word you see further back in Ephesians 4. Oh, David, or who? Oh, Glenn. I'm sorry, I didn't see you there. Oh,
we're still talking about hardness.
Yeah, hardness of heart.
It's an inability to accept the truth of God.
I would say almost even, it can become an inability, but it's at first a refusal to accept the truth of God.
But it goes deeper than a refusal. It's an inability not to refuse.
And that's what we talked about, how God will allow the heart to become hard, and sort of allow the eyes to become blinder.
At least part of that is in verse 17, talking about the futility of their mind.
It's the continuing to walk in your own delusions, so to speak, making up your own truth. As Wilma was sort of talking about, justifying everything you do, and setting up your own sort of truth apparatus, so that you can continue to walk the way you want to walk, which is away from God, rather than going to God. RC. That's the big thing that we love. That's what we want the most.
If you have a hardness of heart, can you even see the truth? I mean, does it?
Eventually, I think there is a. Eventually, yes, that becomes the case. God is, as we said, God is the one ultimately hardens the heart. And sort of blinds us to the truth after we refuse it. It's as if he says, all right, you're going to reject, then I'm going to completely turn you over to yourself. Now I'm starting to forget the question a little bit, but just repeat it for me a sec, Sheila. Eventually, no. You become, you can, and that's the sad part of it, is eventually you, the ramifications of not seeking truth, which is the pain you bring upon yourself, sometimes it even amounts to physical and certain sinful activities, you refuse to acknowledge that as pain anymore. That become you. It's exchanging the truth for a lie. That's exchanging blessing. You know, it's almost embracing your curse, and that's in that's the progression that takes place. It just builds and builds and builds on itself, so that again, very. One of the essential tenets of our faith is the idea of total depravity, and yet no man is completely, all men are given over to their own mind, but no man is as completely evil as he can possibly be. But there are certain men who embrace evil more than others and who go into darker and darker places. God is able to restrain that in certain non-Christians for the sake of the elect in his church. But again, it's in some ways because of this hidden hand of his in their life that they still will refuse to acknowledge. So I don't know if that is that it, okay.
But now, yeah. This was the question I had the other day. Are you talking about a believer being born
to part? Oh. Non-believer, okay. Yes, there's a... We did... thank you for bringing that back up again. That's a good distinction. The idea that God will sometimes harden the saints, although it's not the same kind of hardening. It's for their reclamation. It's sort of turning them over to their own sin and their own pain. But when a saint experiences that, when someone who's been regenerated experiences that, it's like Daphne brought up the idea of, of a child, you keep telling a child, don't touch something. And then finally, you let them touch it. And then that's what finally gets the point through to them. And the same is true for a Christian. God will, don't touch. And then there's sometimes where he lets us touch. But when we're Christians, we pull back and we get the lesson. That's why he lets us touch it. A non-Christian, though, when their mind is devoid of truth and when their heart is hardened and to the degree to the point of no longer being able to feel, they'll touch the flame and they'll just hold their hand in it. The lies are so complete that they won't acknowledge that their hand, the flesh being burned off their hand and permanently scarring themselves, is pain or is bad even, and that's the in certain, and yet at the same time, God can even with some people use that to reclaim them. There is some times where he will, in his wisdom, all powerful wisdom, allow that to
be carrying that analogy a little bit too far, because God has built into all of us a reflex action against touching something that's hot.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to get off of that.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to just, even the most hard-hearted, unregenerate soul is going to get off of a hot object.
Not when you look at something though like homosexuality, or you look at deep drug abuse, people will pursue sin unto death sometimes, though. We talked about that in the discussion on suicide last week, about almost though a suicidal lifestyle and a full embracing. And that's what I meant by holding the hand in the flame there. That's what I'm saying, though. There are some, and I should have said extreme cases, but that's what I had in mind when I said that. I don't mean that that's what most people in the world do, but there are some people who do become so hardened that they become feeling, or Phil, I think you had your hand up first.
Yeah, in the context of what you're teaching in the scripture that you're studying, though, I've seen it in my life, and I wouldn't be surprised if I mean, the exhortation here is to be, as I just read a few minutes ago, living in the Spirit, seeking, you know, toiling for God, working for God. In our lives, what we tend to do as humans, without God's intercession, is we move off in our own understanding, in our own directions. And in those cases, that Spirit, and that relationship with God, because of our sinfulness, is not as strong. Now, he doesn't persevere with the saints, I totally believe in, but there has been times in my life that I wasn't reading my scriptures daily. I was doing sinful things because I was putting myself first. And his Spirit and his hand over my life wasn't as strong. I kind of think that this scripture is addressing the Christians more than the sinners.
Oh, I said, and that's, I fully agree with you, but I believe Paul is saying, note the sinner in the world, and know that you are not completely beyond that. Know that although you have been regenerated, that flesh is still with you, and that you still have the capacity, even if it's not to the degree of the man in the world, to lie to yourself, to delude yourself. And we know that we lie to ourselves. I mean, each one of us, I think, or at least would hope, know that we lie to ourselves on a daily basis still, and that we still have the capacity to do that. R.C.
Well, that's what I was going to say. You talk about holding your hand against the blame or whatever. Satan blinds our eyes to, most of the time, what really is happening. And it ain't that flame eating up your hand or whatever. Everything's is pleasurable or whatever, and then after the fact
we. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing is as Christians we still have, you know, like I said, we recoil when we touch. We don't, as ourselves, keep holding on. But the thing is, don't touch the flame at all. That's what Paul's saying. That you still can't totally trust yourself, and be aware of that. That you still are the greatest danger to yourself. Oh, it's a group effort, no.
But another thing, too, I mean, that was exactly what God told Adam. He said, I mean, anything else?
Mm-hmm. And that we repeat the same sin again and again. And the fact, we all do it. It's not as if Adam did it and the rest of us are exclusively suffering for what he did. We prove that we're Adam's sons because we do the same thing that Adam did. Debbie. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's, I said, that's the ultimate difference between.
With the Holy Spirit indwelled, a true believer could never get away from. No, that, even if it's a tiny bit of conviction in there.
He is completely faithful to us. That's absolutely the case, and but the thing I think said last week, I think part of the overall point of this passage is. Oh, that Paul doesn't want us to let our guard down. And that's what I'm not saying. I don't want to confuse confuse the two. I'm not saying at all a believer can lose their salvation or anything like that. But at the same time, we have to keep our wits about us. And we're almost certainly not going to harm ourselves the way that people in the world harm themselves. But when you see churches with infighting and bickering, that's proof that although people's flesh may be dying, it's not dead yet. And that we still have the capacity to hurt each other, even as Christians. Oh, that was a bird, though. And so I think that's maybe the bigger thing to keep in mind here is not necessarily the idea of hurting ourselves, although we are very capable of doing that, but as Christians, we need to remember how capable we are of hurting each other. And that's, as I said last week, the people in the church are the greatest danger to the church. It's not the people outside of the church. And the reason why we are is because although we have been made alive in Christ, as Paul talks about in other places, the flesh is still with us. The flesh is dying, but it's not dead yet. It's like a wounded, I read once about the old time sort of bear hunting, and how the most dangerous bear was the one that had been wounded, even that had been deadly wounded. It was mortally wounded, but it was even more capable of striking out, and that's the way our flesh is. It's been mortally wounded, but it's still capable of striking us, and even worse, it's capable of striking other people through us. You know, the spirit and the flesh difference. We read Galatians 6, remember, last week. You know, Paul's warning. Those are Christians. Paul's warning about the works of the flesh and how we must continue to put it to death. But part of, you can't put it to death, if you can't continue the process of putting it to death if you think it's already dead. Does that make sense? Or is that, you chuckle, is that?
Well, that's so true. If you think you're well, you can be terribly sick, but you still think you're well.
And then you hurt yourself even more because of that. And I think that's, again, why we asked the question last week about why does the good church need to hear this? The good church, as much as it has a greater temptation to think that it's safe, or to think, that thought can. I mean, I can't tell you how many times that at least. Go ahead, Glenn.
Almost irresistible propensity to say things that are kind of over the edge of ugly, not exactly ugly, but a little sharp, a little.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't watch continually, I'm going to hurt somebody with my tongue. It's usually my tongue that does the hurting.
And I'll tell you, you're not alone in that at all.
I've got to be continually on guard. If I once say, oh, well, I'm doing pretty good, I haven't heard anybody all day today, watch out.
Yeah, and why was it you didn't hurt anyone? Because you've gotten better, or because you were watching yourself? And yet the temptation is, the longer we go without doing it, the more we stop doing those practices.
Not as if I'm tempted to do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of my being.
Yeah.
I'm just hard to get along with God.
Mm-hmm.
one of the blessings of being reformed is we know how terrible we are, and we keep telling ourselves that.
No, we do.
1 Corinthians 10:10.
Which one? 1 Corinthians 10?
'Be careful that you don't fall. No temptation has seized you except what is common to men. God is faithful and unable to be tempted beyond what you can bear. When you're tempted, you will also provide a way out, so that you can stand there.
Yeah, it's the idea that you're. It's not that you won't be tempted. It's that you're. If God will give you a way out, He is faithful. But don't think that you're not going to be tempted. And don't think that you are, like I said, keep going back to last week, but I told you the story about one of my professors at RTS who had heard a guest speaker who was of the sort of second, or even sometimes you have a third blessing movement, with the idea that your sanctification can go to such a degree that you actually believe you don't consciously sin anymore, or that you've gotten beyond that. That's a very dangerous place, I would say. Extremely dangerous place. And that's a place Paul, I think, is trying to warn them not to go. Other thoughts? You guys, it's funny. You've basically been the ones leading me through my own notes here rather than, but it's very, and I say that as a great compliment. So I'm grateful for it. Any other thoughts or questions before we move on to the second, another section here?
It just seems like the core problem in all of this sin is personal autonomy. Not understanding that we're the creature, it's the creator. We're seeking our own freedom, our own autonomy, and that's what leads us to all of this.
I think virtually, yeah, every sin, the heart of every sin is the desire not to submit. It's the reason for the fall. We want to be God. The envy there is so great. And the temptation, it's as strange as it sounds, because we can love God with all our hearts, and yet we still have this little part in our mind that would rather be in His place. That's part of the dilemma. No,
it's also kind of like you were saying, you know, we want to be God. We want control. We don't have that control.
Even if we did, we wouldn't know what to do with it. It would be, you know, we'd be spinning out of control.
I don't want that position.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the evil thoughts, like I was reading, I did a little bit of study on this from another class.
Uh-huh.
Matthew 15:19, you know, the bad thoughts come from a bad heart.
Yeah.
You know, and I have to bite my tongue a lot where I live, especially at 4:30 in the morning. I just want to go out there and rip everybody's head off out there fighting.
Yeah.
On. But, you know, I sit back and I tell myself, what would Jesus do?
Mm-hmm.
What would Jesus do? So.
Yeah. That's what we, conforming ourselves to the person of Christ. We'll read about that, and we did already earlier in this chapter. Being like Christ to each other, which doesn't mean that we don't speak honestly to each other. It doesn't mean that we don't sometimes have to call each other to account. That's part of speaking the truth in love also. You can't simply let, you know, Glenn used the idea of being a sick person, but thinking you're well. Well, you know, you see someone whose body is ravaged by flu or has a broken leg and they're just trying to walk on it like nothing's wrong, then you don't love them if you don't say, look, you need to be back in bed, or look, you need to get that seen to. And there's a spiritual way we do that too. But also, piggybacking a little bit off something that Glenn said, because of our own sinful nature, we are also sometimes tempted to use those flaws we see in other people as simply a way of expressing our own superiority or establishing a kind of a dominance on our own part.
Isn't the secret to speak the truth, yes,
mm-hmm.
but to speak it in love?
That's, love is the key to that. Yeah. You're not going to be able to do ministry if that isn't there. Because ministry requires speaking honestly to people. And that's why, just, I'll give you one quick sec. I'm a product of the mainline church, and I believe a big reason the mainline church fell away is because it stopped doing this. It stopped speaking the truth to people. And it's not that discipline itself went away. I'm sure if you were to go back to my home church in Peru, Indiana, there hadn't been a discipline case in over 100 years. I have no proof of that, but I would be stunned if there had been. And that is the definition of not loving. The parent, the true parent who doesn't love their children is the parent who doesn't discipline. Who just says, oh, let them go on their way. I can't be bothered with doing that. Anger itself is not the antithesis of love. Indifference is the true antithesis of love. And that's, and so when you do nothing, that's in some ways a way of hating the person, a person especially you've been charged with serving.
Well, what I was going to add to this, I think something I have learned over time is working with a lot of women's groups is in doing something. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking to someone at 4:30 in the morning or speaking to them at some other point in time of the day, I think we need to realize we're never going to do it perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
There may be times when speaking the truth in love, we might not do it right. Okay? But I think the beauty in living out the faith and people seeing us walking the walk instead of just talking the talk is coming back and saying, you know what, I think when I said it that way, that might not have been exactly the way it needed to have been said, to apologize and let them see that happen. Because we're not in the news perfectly. I know we can hear this, but fleshing it out into our everyday lives and situations, I think sometimes it's terrifying to think we've got to call, we've got to talk with somebody. But I think realizing that maybe we overstepped the boundary.
That's
correct.
That's what.
So many people are terrified to apologize or to say, you know what, I was wrong.
Absolutely. That's where the humility comes in. That's why the humility is, we talk.
I mean, we can talk about, you know, saying something and speaking the truth in love, but knowing how that fits into this specific situation, it's impossible. So you have to pray through it and work through it, and then when you say it, you come back and you think it didn't, that didn't come across right, or it still didn't restore a relationship, you got to go back and revisit it.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard.
Extremely hard. That's in RC.
Mm-hmm. When you have the highest of motives when you said something, and do you get mad at them, or do you just...
Do you have an answer to that, Debbie, or...
Well, the other side of speaking of love is to extend grace to that person. Not get something out of shape over everything he said to you. I mean, you've got to extend grace to that person, too. That's what dealing in love is about between two believers.
Mm-hmm.
Give me some grace, and, you know... Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Non-believer needs to see you say, you know what, I think I overstepped.
Yeah, especially non-believer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That goes.
But with believers, extend grace. The other person's human.
Most non-believers don't know what to do with it if you go back. That really takes them aback. And it's a great witness. So.
Mm-hmm. This is what it's really about.
Mm-hmm.
That you're a real person.
Helen, what are you going to say?
I was just going to address whatever Steve said.
Mm-hmm. There's only so much we can do, and the first part of the first priority is make sure we have everything at least in order on our end, and that our conscience is at least clear that we've done all we can for the person. And then you said you turn it over to God. It may be, God, it's a time release thing where it's something that maybe isn't initially received, but that God will use days or weeks or who knows how long down the road. Who knows, maybe it, and sometimes that can be a part of a person's hardening too, though. So, Debbie.
I heard one preacher say that speaking the truth in love, when someone comes up and says that, you need to run.
No.
I'm going to say something, I'm going to speak the truth in love, and you need to run.
It's interesting. Not quite sure what to make of that, but...
I've always found that when you speak the truth among your rejected, you might have an extra retort. It's a pox on you and all your relatives, aren't we?
Yeah, and that's their problem at that point. You know, sometimes you just have to leave it. That's their problem. But we've already...
I have one more question.
Okay, absolutely.
This person who has rejected that, so do you just...
Dismiss them and never speak to them again? Or no. Yeah. But you're when you have the highest of motives for something and they blow you out of the water and reject you.
I mean, and there it's not a black and white. There's a lot of gray in there. And it's every circumstance is different. Maybe, you know, maybe it's someone you can't get away from. And you just have to agree. And, you know, like I said, there's a fair amount of playing it by ear in that. So. Usually you'll have a reasonably good idea of whether or not you can continue in it or whether something needs to be back.
To the level of forgiveness too, because you just forgive the fact that they did it. And just because you've forgiven somebody doesn't mean you have to be their best buddy.
Oh, and it doesn't mean that they still aren't.
There may have to be a separation.
And it still doesn't mean that they don't need to acknowledge their guilt either. You can still keep asking for retribution on their part, but... At the same time, there's still an obligation on the, you know, for RC.
Let's look at the mirror. How about when somebody speaks?
You guys are the horse this morning, and I'm the cart. So, but that's what. But that's, you know, that was the section here is that I was about to get into is the idea that this has a two-way street. We're required to speak it to others, but we're also required to be able to hear it when it's spoken to us.
I think we need to remember too, Christ spoke in love and he was hurt.
Absolutely. He's killed.
Why should we expect anything differently?
There's some times where that will.
Christ spoke in love and he's hurt.
That's part of the way we're conformed to him. And so we shouldn't think that there's anything necessarily going wrong if that happens, if we find ourselves having to bear our own cross in those situations. That's you're called to be like Christ, and you're going to find yourself in situations similar to what he found himself in. That's part of how he teaches us through those things. You know, weeping for Jerusalem, even though he knew they were going to put him to death. Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. Debbie, you were going to say something? Never mind. Okay. But
are we taking this out of speaking the truth in love? You're thinking of criticizing and this, that, and the other, and sometimes it's not just not none of your business, and it's the discipline of the elders that gets in.
It is. There's, like I said, this is not a completely black and white thing.
Yeah.
It depends sometimes. You do have to be careful, though, of these hidden resentments that can come in and this idea of giving room to the devil. If someone has truly offended you, if you forgive them for that, then you truly have to forgive them. And sometimes people will offend you unconsciously. It may just be they did something stupid and they didn't mean to do it, something along those lines. And in those cases, then you can sometimes let it go without, if it wasn't deliberate, then you can let it go. But if you let it go, you really got to let it go. I remember once when I was grew up on a farm. We had a big shed, a lot of implements and, you know, tools and things like that. My dad had an air compressor, a fairly good sized one, heavy duty. And my dad was out one morning. I remember it was probably in November. It was a cold, gray morning. And about 9, 10 o'clock, there was this incredible explosion, just noise from down in the barnyard area. And my mom was frightened by what, that could not have been good. Indeed, it was so loud, our neighbor, farmer, who lived three-quarters of a mile away, he heard and he actually came over. And my mom was scared that something had happened, but she was too scared to actually go down and look to see if, something had happened to my dad. So the neighbor went down there and looked and said, my dad wasn't there. He'd gone out and done some errands. I'd gone into town without telling anybody, but which wasn't uncommon at all. But apparently I don't know how exactly how it works, but the release valve on the air compressor had been broken, and the thing had just kept sucking in air and sucking in air and sucking in air until it exploded. It probably would have killed someone if they'd been down there, but. That's not unlike how things like this happen with us, and it's a reason why we can't simply, why we do have to say something when someone has given us offense. Paul talks about, it's not simply us, talks about giving room for the devil. The devil knows when you're not letting something go, and he will pick at that. It's like, this wall looks flat, but when we don't let these things go, it's like a little crack in the wall, and he'll just pick away at that, widen it out until he's weakened the whole integrity, the strength of the wall, until it starts to crumble. And that's, again, Paul wants us to realize how serious these things are that we're dealing with. And again, recognize, not simply for our own sake, but for the sake of the people who are around us, it's me for your sake that I need to be aware of these things. On the one hand, why we have to go to someone else when offense has been given, especially if it's been something deliberate, or we feel like And I know this happened a few times with me, but the people who have done it for me, I've come to see, are some of the best friends I've had in the church, people who are able to speak honestly. And at the same time, the very few times I've had to do it, I probably count out on one hand, but it was people who I was some of the closest friends I was with, and it actually made those friendships even closer. R.C.
Help me understand. We keep talking about speaking truthfully, and we keep talking about, like, if it's a personal relationship between somebody you're speaking to, but it says, put on falsehoods and speak truthfully to your neighbor. That don't just talk about stuff between us. That's stuff all around. That could be anything.
It's more essential in the church because you're more because when you lash back at someone in the church, it has ramifications all around. But it's essential to yourself, and that's why you at least have to try with people in the world too. You can't, they can.
We're talking about like insult people, but I'm talking about like a brother in the church is saying, this is better than that. He's not insulting me. I'm saying, no, truthfully, this is better than
that's where the pride comes in too, is it ceases to become a pursuit of truth, and it becomes a case of saying, or it can, and this is very often what happens in churches, is it becomes personal. We talked, I think this a couple weeks ago, how you can be speaking about something abstract, but when it becomes personal to you, and your pride starts to be on the line, then it can flip. Then it can become, then the actual thing the truth you're trying to discover becomes irrelevant, and it's again a case of me against you for the case of demonstrating who's superior, and not letting your pride get knocked down.
Your truth and I have mine.
There's a profound amount of Christian maturity in being able to say that honestly. Now, I don't say, some people just say it because they can't be bothered, but when you're able to honestly say that, with another Christian, we talked a long time ago about the idea of I know they're a Christian, but being able to still acknowledge a person as a brother or sister and then honestly agree to disagree, not simply go through the motions of that, but be able to honestly say that's takes an incredible amount of maturity, spiritual maturity to be able to do that.
There's the key, I think, is in verse 29,
mm-hmm.
where you said, let no corrupting talk out of your mouth, but only such as is good for building up and fits the occasion. Now, you can speak the truth that fits the occasion. You can also speak the same truth
mm-hmm.
in another situation. It doesn't fit. The key is to that it may give grace to those who hear.
That's
the motivation, is to give grace to those who hear.
And that's why something like gossip is so damaging, because it's truth being spoken but without grace. It's truth being spoken not for purely for entertainment most of the time. Sometimes it's other cases you're not seeking to build up the other person. Now I've run into Christians before who have a very sensitive conscience and think to say anything critical about anybody, especially to someone else, is wrong. And we do have to be aware of our motives for speaking about certain issues, but it's the simple question, is what I'm saying for the benefit of the person I'm saying it to, and even for the benefit of the person I may be talking about? Am I earnestly trying to express a concern for the betterment of the kingdom, or am I simply either trying to entertain myself or trying to make myself look better by talking about someone else's flaws or faults? And I think we're starting to get in. We said the speaking the truth is very, but then this having our conversation, seeking to have our conversation always be edifying, that's starting to get up in some very rarefied air as far as sanctification is concerned. It's the sort of jettisoning the sarcasm and the other things that we talked about. Which doesn't mean that... I won't go there. I'll hold off. Maybe next week, but I have a chance to think it out a little bit more. But we'll touch briefly, though, on the idea of making ourselves ready to hear what someone else might have to say. And I think there's two keys to that here in our last... we've got a couple more minutes. Maybe we'll flesh this out a little bit more next week. But... at least write it down. We probably have to flesh this out a little bit more next week. But in fact, I think we'll leave that to next week, actually, and we'll just have an extra 5 minutes for fellowship. So unless any other thoughts or questions, we've still got a little bit of time, but I think I'll save this. Wilma. There's an aspect of it where it's like that, where, you know, you do have it before, you do... am I going to do this for the person, or am I going to do that? There is a way in which we have to make a decision when we talk, when we interact, when we speak, when we have to... officers have to make that decision a lot, is... and why am I going to say what I'm going to say? That's part of the reason our Presbyterian meetings are so long, because most people don't... Anyway, never mind, I won't say. Any other questions or thoughts? So...